Start recording and get started. So last time we talked about counting semaphores. So we mentioned that we had these two fundamental operations, this down operation, which decremented the integer held by the semaphore, waiting first if it would be negative, and up, which incremented it, or if another thread was trying to decrement, would wake up that thread and the increment and decrement would cancel out. And our intuition for using these counting semaphores, we learned, was that we choose some number which should be zero when we want to be waiting, and build our semaphore that way. So we just naturally try to adjust that number using these down and up operations, and it would turn out that when we try to adjust it to something that would be, you know, below zero, we'd end up waiting when we were supposed to wait, and not waiting when we weren't. Then we looked at reader-writer locks. So these were sort of a much more specific construct. So monitors and semaphores, we could like do tons of stuff with. Reader-writer locks are for a very specific but extremely common problem, which is that we have some shared data. We can read it from multiple threads at the same time because, well, those threads are going to get the same values. There's not going to be any confusion about what's happening. But we can only write from one place at a time because we don't want it to be the case that that if we're, say, appending to a list, we get confused about what the size of the list is during that operation, that, you know, we start thinking we append at index 10 and actually someone else trying to do that at the same time. We want to avoid that sort of problem. Or if we're reading while someone's writing, we want to not, you know, think we're iterating the whole list, but we're not iterating like past the end because it's being, say, shortened. So reader-writer locks are a convenient way of providing that protection, but giving the extra flexibility of allowing us to read from multiple places at once. And we talked about implementing reader-writer locks with monitors. So typically that would be probably not what you do because we have threading libraries which provide it, but we discovered that in making the implementation, we had this sort of design decision we had to make, which is, do we prefer readers or writers when we have a choice? That if a writer is done writing, well, do we want to let another writer go right away, or do we want to let readers go right away? And we learned that with monitors, we could make this choice by tracking the number of readers and writers and using that information to actually decide who gets to run next. And we saw that kind of a detail that's often missed in dealing with that is, is that we, you know, changed the waiting condition and the signaling condition to make this work. To make this happen, we couldn't just change one and expect to have the correct results. Then finally, we finished up by talking about deadlocks, which will be our first topic after we go through questions about things we covered last week today. And deadlocks, we learned, were these circular dependencies that resulted in indefinite waiting. And as the name suggests, they're very common with locks, but we saw that they could happen with other resources. And we'll go through more formally what the conditions for deadlock are. But sort of our classic example is we have two threads which acquire locks in a different order. And in between acquiring these two locks, well, if both threads manage to get to where I've drawn this dot, well, thread one is going to be waiting on thread two because thread two has B locked, and thread two is going to be waiting on thread one because thread one has A locked. So questions about things we covered last time or the quiz? I have some questions on the quiz, so I'll start by doing that. So one question on the quiz is, for question two, choice D, won't the else statement always be executed? Yes, I believe that's correct, so I probably should give everyone credit for this option. I will write myself a note to do that after this lecture. Since I understand not selecting it because it obviously doesn't make sense. So So it's incorrect in that sense. And then a question, what is going on with question four? So question four is asking what goes in the blanks labeled one and two. And what we want to have happen here is that we try to lock, and we discover that this lock is already locked. So we mark ourselves as a waiter. We release this internal mutex that protects the isLocked flag and these waiter counts. And then we're waiting. Then we don't want to actually keep going because, well, if it was already locked, we can't go yet. So we have to do something that actually is going to have us wait for the lock to be available for us. So this must be a wait operation for that reason. If we had a post operation, then we discover the lock is locked, increase the number of waiters, and then we get out of this lock as VIP function right away, which wouldn't make sense. And the same is true with lock as normal. And then a question about 6A. So the question is adding is locked equals false before the statement labeled 3. And is locked equals true after the statements labeled 1 and 2. So it's true that it seems like adding is locked equals false up here doesn't seem like a problem by itself because, well, the mutex is locked. No one's going to notice that that's happening. The problem is that if we just add it before 3, when we release the mutex, it will be locked. Sorry, it will be marked as unlocked, which is fine, but we'll have signaled someone, say, here, that they can use the mutex. And with the code as written here, they'll assume they can get the lock, but what might have happened is in the meanwhile, someone else may have got the lock using this else path of code here. So it could end up being the case that two threads get the lock with the change suggested in 6A. And then for asking about 6C. So in 6C, we're asking about moving this decrement of VIP waiters. So it's the case, we follow a discipline in all this code that VIP waiters is only written here, or written here, or read here. And that's always done with this mutex. So it doesn't matter if we do it, exactly when we write VIP waiters, as long as, you know, we do it, you know, in the same act of locking it. So I can move this VIP waiters right here before or after, and no one's going to be able to see a difference from another thread because they always acquire the mutex first, and they won't be able to get the mutex until we get all the way out of this if-else statement. That's for 6C. And then a question for 6B, wouldn't it not work since it releases the lock before making the change? So we're asking about in after 1 here. So it's true that we'd be changing is locked without the mutex held, which is problematic. But because of how we're going to be signaled, we know that this code down here, which signals us, has to be running with isLocked already true. So we're just setting isLocked to a value it already has, and that's not going to change what anyone reads for the lock. And And if we're thinking about, we're saying, and we're going to have, and if you're worried about reordering, well, we're going to have this wait operation that's going to force that that to be synchronized to other threads in a safe way, as far as memory reordering goes for 6B. Where was I on this list of questions? So for question 5, why is the starting value 0 instead of 1? So the way I think about it is, what do I want to happen the first time this code runs? And the first time we're going to get to is locked. If it's locked, that means that someone already locked and is in unlock and hasn't gotten to unlock yet. And in that case, we want to wait that first time. And because we want to wait the first time, I concluded the value should be 0 and not 1. If it was 1, that means that I could call lock SVIP twice and both calls would return immediately, and that would be bad. That's on question 5, which there's a lot about. And then for asking number 1, how do we know, how do we distinguish between H and J? So let's say this limit is 1. In that case, you know, we want one retrieval at a time. In that case, we'd want to wait while there is one retrieval going on. So that's why how I concluded it has to be greater than equal and not greater than. Because if we had this greater than, we'd allow two retrievals if the limit was set to 1. So that. So that, and then for question 3 asking, so we said that we could, this option of replacing with a broadcast call would result in the appropriate number of waiting threads. So it's true that this might wake up threads that can't do anything, but because of this loop up here, they won't actually start a retrieval. Does that answer the question? So we want a little more detail. So let's say we have a con broadcast here and the new limit is 0. Well, what's going to happen is all the threads that were waiting are going to wake up, or they're going to check their while condition, and they're going to find out, oh, well, 0 is greater than or equal, well, the number of active retrievals is greater than or equal to 0, so I have to wait again. So they're not going to actually make any progress. And yes, I guess in retrospect, I should have written something a little more explicit of starts an appropriate number of waiting threads retrievals to be more explicit about this. I'm sorry about that. This was not the phrasing I would have chosen if I had thought about this very carefully. Yeah, so I probably should consider making an adjustment to that question too because of that. I meant starts retrievals, but this is for 3A. So I'll probably make an adjustment to that one because of that other interpretation, which is reasonable. But my intention was starts a reach retrieval. Threads start, like, actually working and not just checking the condition. Okay, other questions, including about quiz or things we covered last time? Okay. So, last time we kind of introduced deadlock kind of informally. Let's do a more formal definition. So deadlock, circular waiting for resources, and as I said last time, it's defined pretty generically. That resources could be locks, could be like CPU time, disk space, memory, anything that a thread needs to do work, and that, you know, that you can't really, you know, share with other threads all the time. Like, we can share CPU time, but we share it by kind of splitting it up. Like, there's going to be, you know, some contention, and that's where we can have deadlocks, because we can have waiting for CPU time or waiting for locks happen. So note that deadlock is different than starvation. So we saw starvation when we saw priority scheduling, that we could have a low priority thread that never gets to run because of high priority threads. But this is not deadlock, because the two things are not waiting for each other. The low priority threads waiting on the high priority threads, but the high priority threads aren't waiting on the low priority threads. And in a deadlock, in contrary, we have this circular waiting, so no one makes progress. Another way of looking at it is that with starvation, since we don't have that circular waiting, we can resolve starvation by just taking turns. We can say, okay, we have starvation, let's just let everyone go one at a time, and that will fix starvation. With deadlock, that won't solve the problem. If we have one thread waiting on the other, we can try to let the first thread go, but it can't. We can try to let the second thread go, but it can't. Taking turns is not enough to solve the problem. So, since we have this informal definition, let's do our formal definition of deadlock. So here are a list of requirements for deadlock that sort of make up a definition. So we have mutual exclusion, that we need to have some sort of resource that when one thread takes it, other threads can't have it. So if that's not the case, we're not going to have deadlock. So locks clearly meet this criteria. They're like, that's the what they're designed to do. But other resources can work this way, like allocating memory or, you know, using a file or things like that. We need to have hold and wait, that a thread that's holding one resource needs to wait to acquire another resource. So there's sort of two parts of this, that this hold part means that, you know, after we get one thing, one resource source, and this wait thing means that we'll wait to get another. We also need to have no preemption of resources. So with the CPU, for example, like maybe we'd be waiting on, you know, some thread to get CPU time, but that we can like take away the CPU from another thread. So we never have deadlock with that sort of thing with our preemptive schedulers. But for deadlock to happen, the resources that are involved need to be things that are only released voluntarily. They aren't going to be things which are going to be stolen from the program, like we steal the CPU out from under a program. And if a program's running, we might take away its CPU, and that, you know, keeps us from having deadlock with the CPU. But we don't, like, take away a lock from a thread that has a lock. And another criteria is circular wait, that we have sort of a cycle where one is waiting on two, two is waiting on three, up to n is waiting back on one. So there's some sort of loop. This can involve any number of threads, not just two, though two is going to be our most common case because that's what, you know, most commonly we see, but it can happen with these more arbitrarily large number of threats. So questions on this these sort of criteria for our definition. Okay, so let's do exercise here. So let's say we have a doubly linked list, and the elements of our list are A, then B, then C, then D, then E. So this is our linked list. So the head points to A and the tail pointer points to E. And we run this remove node method here. And let's say we have two or more of these running at the same time. Where could we have deadlock? So note that we're not guaranteed to have deadlock because, well, it just depends on exactly how these get scheduled. But where could we have deadlock? And a question, how is my last name pronounced? It's pronounced Rice. Rhymes with vice. Okay, give another 20 seconds. Okay, so the plurality answer is D, is that A and C, and I believe that is the best answer. The next most popular idea, well, there are two of them. So the next most popular idea is that either all of these can have deadlock or that just C can have deadlock. So first, let's talk about why A can have deadlock. And if A has deadlock, well, C also has deadlock because we could just say, pretend that this remove node D happened like well before, well after B and C ran in parallel, and that would reproduce the deadlock situation from option A. So what's that look like? So we lock B for remove B, and then we lock the thing, the previous thing, and then we wait to lock C, the next thing. And at the same time, remove C, lock C, and waits to lock the previous thing, which is already locked. So we have our circular waiting that the remove B thread is waiting to get the lock on C, which is, you know, so I'll write for, which is held by the thread running remove C, which is waiting to get the lock on B, which is held by remove B. With B and D alone, deadlock isn't possible, and you're going to say, how would we figure that out? So it's because there's only overlap in C. So if we try to draw this sort of picture, we're going to have the lock on C, the lock on B, the lock on A, the lock on E, and the lock, sorry, lock on A. I should draw these things on the right side. Lock on D, E, and the lock on A, B. And if we think about our two threads, we have our remove B thread, which can only have some sort of arrows to A, B, and C, and our remove D thread, which can only have arrows to C, D, and E. So we can have one arrow going in or out of lock on C from either place. We can't get a cycle. There's just no way to get a cycle, so there's no circular wait. Questions on how I figured that out? Or other things about this scenario? Okay. So, most commonly, we're going to want to try to write code which can't deadlock. And this sort of example shows how you could easily do that by accident. And it's, you know, we could figure out in this case where deadlock could happen, but that's actually kind of tricky. So we went to some sort of systematic way of avoiding deadlock. And to do that, we can look at our components of our definition, and we can think of ways of making any one of these criteria not work. So here's a sort of probably exhaustive list, but I'm not entirely sure, of, you know, how we could, you know, avoid deadlock. So one example is that, you know, if we don't have mutual exclusion, then there's no deadlock problem. So if we have infinite resources, we don't have to worry about deadlock with that resource. So when I introduced deadlock, I mentioned, well, we could have deadlock from, you know, contention on memory allocation if we had an allocator wait function. Well, one solution to that is that we could just never run out of memory, or, you know, or something like that. We could not share resources. So if there's no sharing, there's no deadlock. Now, these, you know, only work sometimes. So they work if, like, we're worried about contention on memory. Maybe we can make this sort of thing effectively happen, but usually not. So another sort of approach is that we can avoid waiting. So you can think of here that the problem is that when we try to do this locking, we're waiting, and we could instead do something else. So with memory allocation, we've kind of seen the solution that the reason we don't have deadlocks on systems that you use when you run out of memory is because the program crashes instead. So that's an option we can use for some resources. We can say, rather than waiting, we're just going to fail. And we could imagine doing this for locks, that we could have the lock, instead of the lock, you know, waiting, it could just say, sorry, you can't get the lock, and the program could do something else. Now, the problem is for locks, it's not clear what that would be. But if you had a good idea what you'd want to do, POSIX provides this for locks. There's a try lock function, which fails rather than waiting. And maybe you could, like, retry later, or you could just give up, but that would avoid the deadlock at the cost of, well, you probably wanted the lock for a good reason. So maybe that's not so useful, but in some circumstances it might be fine. Another option is we could have preemption. that we could revoke resources. So if we think about locks, if we had some way of saying, oh, you have the lock here, why don't you stop what you're doing and give up? And you might say, well, that seems really hard to implement, like, because if we imagine here, you know, what let's, you know, if we're waiting here and we want to preempt a lock that, like, I have this lock and you want to get take it away from me while I have it, how would I do you do that? But you could imagine a solution where we have some way of sort of undoing what we're in the middle of doing and, like, maybe retrying it later. The same idea we had with sort of the trial lock idea. And this is actually a strategy that, say, that databases, you know, this sometimes. And the idea is we need a way to undo partial, you know, partial operation and the retry it later. But this is, databases really do use this technique where they'll say, oh, there's a deadlock. Well, I'm going to just look at this thing that we were trying to do. We're going to undo that for now. Let something else run, and then we're going to retry it later, and hopefully there won't be a deadlock that time. But these approaches, you know, if we're thinking of the typical deadlocks you encounter in a normal program, you know, these aren't practical. They aren't going to be efficient. So the most common approach that you're going to use is acquiring resources in a consistent order. And this attacks the circular wait idea, that we're going to avoid cycles by always getting things in a particular order. And it's not intuitive exactly why this prevents deadlocks entirely. But the sort of, but one way of thinking about it is to think about the graph. That if we have that graph, you know, to get that circular waiting, we needed a thread that was acquiring a lock in the other order from another thread. That, you know, that in this case, if these filled in boxes represent threads, that this thread is holding the lock on the left side while waiting for the lock on the right side, which means that it must have acquired the lock on the left side first when the thread on the bottom acquired the lock on the left side second. If we say that they're going to agree to always acquire them in the same order, we'll avoid these cycles. And this is by far the most common strategy for actually avoiding deadlocks, and we'll look at it in a little more detail in a second. A last strategy that maybe would be practical is you can imagine, rather than, you know, holding the resource, getting one thing and then waiting for the next thing you need, if we had some way of, say, you know, pthread, mutex, multi-lock, if that existed, which it doesn't, you know, that would also solve this problem. If we had some way of getting all the resources all together. So questions about the sort of general taxonomy of deadlock prevention techniques. So let's look at, so the question is, the linked list had consistent order but still deadlocked. So it did not have consistent order because let's think about the order we had in these cases. So remove B acquired B, then A, then C, and remove C acquired C, then B, then D. And we have a disagreement about whether we require B first or B second. So that's where our inconsistent order was. So how do we avoid that? Well, we could just do something like choose an order. So for example, we had that move file example earlier. We could just say, I'm just going to choose the thing with the name, which is alphabetically lower. The ordering doesn't matter. Any order will do. It just needs to be consistent. So, you know, once we choose an order, it's fine. So, that's fine. So, in this case, it's kind of tricky to choose an order because we really want to lock node before we access prev or next fields. And that makes actually, you know, avoiding this sort of deadlock, if you want to have this sort of locking for a linked list, very difficult. And typically the solution is you have one lock for the whole list rather than a lock for each node. Or you do something a lot more complicated. But in like our move file example, well, we have a fromdir and a toDir. We just choose an order between them. Doesn't matter what we choose. Can be arbitrary. And if you look at large software projects, generally this is the strategy they'll use. So for example, in the Linux kernel, there's often these comments saying, oh, we have these a whole bunch of locks. Here is the order you acquire them in so we don't deadlock. And they just have these comments and the people writing the code hopefully look at these comments before they decide, you know, oh, I need to, what? When should I acquire these locks to make this work? So, questions about lock order? Okay. So, that basically concludes what I was going to say about threads for this class, except I'm going to talk about not using threads. So we've told you how to program threads. We're having assignments where you program with multiple threads. And very often in the real world, the correct thing to do is not use threads. So I'm going to talk about alternatives to threads just very briefly. We're not going to do examples of these. But the reason I'm going to talk about this is because, well, threads are error prone. You have to worry about things like deadlock and correct locking and race conditions. So it sure would be easier if we could avoid worrying about those. And there's some cases where you might think, oh, I need to use threads to do this, where that's not true. So I'd like to introduce like two alternative models where you can often avoid this. So one is event-based programming. So if you have, for example, a server that has multiple clients that's serving lots of, you know, different, say, web browsers at the same time, often you'd be tempted to use threads, not because you actually want to take advantage of multiple cores, but because you want to handle multiple connections, and it seems like you have to read and write from them at the same time. If you want to do this, you can do this generally with a single thread, but the way you're going to read and write is going to be very different. So typically, what's going to happen is that you're going to have something that I'll call an event loop, where you'll have some function that will tell you when you can like get a new connection, you can read and write, and this will tell you when you can do these things without waiting. And so in this way, you can sort of have this loop where you handle multiple connections, where like you get events which say, this connection has data for you to read, and you can handle reading that, and then go back to the top of this loop and then say, oh, this connection is ready for me to write, so I'm going to write now. And you never have to worry about, say, read or write hanging your program because, well, you'll only call read or write when this wait for next event function tells you, yes, you can read or write now. And obviously, the actual name of this functionality isn't wait for next event, but this sort of functionality is provided in POSIX by the select and pull functions, where they take a list of file descriptors and they tell you when you can read or write them without waiting, and you can use that to implement this kind of loop. And similar functionality exists in more OS-specific ways, so Linux has another thing called epoll, which is arguably better than select or pull. Windows has something called IO completion ports, which do something similar. This functionality of reading or writing in a way where you can like handle multiple connections at once is very common and often a more convenient way to structure your program because, well, you don't have to worry about race conditions here. There's one thread. Another notable model that you might see is that instead of having sort of shared memory, you can do message passing, that you can have basically different processes that communicate via something like a pipe. And this is a very common programming model. Most notably, like, it's what you have to do anyways on so-called supercomputers, because a supercomputer these days is really just a bunch of powerful normal computers networked together, and they usually can't efficiently share memory anyways, so you need to send messages between the different machines that make that up. And you can use this model even locally. And there's no locking issues, so it's often a very much more convenient and less error-prone way to code things up, that where you might even need to use multiple cores, but maybe you don't want to deal with the annoyance of figuring out how to make locking work. So questions about events and message passing. Question, events still handle one input at a time? Yes. The idea is that, you know, you'll handle it piecemeal. So, like, you know, you'll take part of the input from one connection, do what you can with it, and then go to the next input that's available. So the question is, these methods are used more often in industry than threading? That's hard to say. So as a concrete example for event loops, probably the most high-performance web servers are event loop-based. So those are relatively commonly used, but I think probably more servers overall are written in a thread-based manner because that's often considered more convenient to program, even with the dealing with locking. Question, what is the value in learning threads? So threads are a convenient programming model. I just don't want you to think they're the only choice you have. And, you know, the usual thoughts I'd make is like, what's going to make more sense for my application? And, you know, like, this event loop avoids all that locking and such, so I like it. But if we're thinking about, like, how do I code something up where I have to write this handle read function, that's actually arguably pretty annoying if you want to write code that looks more like what you'd write to handle a connection at a time. You know, it's going to look very different. That might be annoying to do. You might prefer threads, even though locking is annoying. And I guess if we're talking about message passing, you might think that shared variables are easier than sending messages, and they might be faster than sending messages in some cases. Okay. Anything else about event loops or message passing? So when is threading preferred is the question? This is a subjective question. You'll get different opinions. Some people will tell you that you should always prefer threads because it's more intuitive, and they can be implemented very efficiently if you know what you're doing. I lean more on I would use threads in cases where I have to worry about dealing with code that's sort of not designed to handle this event loop style, like, which often comes up with like libraries, or where I need to take advantage of multiple cores, I'd probably use threads, and otherwise I would avoid it. And question, what's the format of message passing? There are tons of different implementations, which, you know, vary significantly. If you want to look at a concrete example, look up MPI, which is probably the most common implementation of this message passing idea. Okay, so our next topic is going to be virtual memory. And virtual memory has a bit of a prereq issue here. So in 3330 or COA 2, we've covered virtual memory arguably extensively, though I keep doubting that every time I see how much people who've taken those courses remember in this course. But in theory, we've covered virtual memory for a while in those courses. In CPE, the story's not so great. So CPE's prereq for this class is CPE's embedded class, which has at best very minimal coverage of virtual memory. It's not the architecture class, which is where there might be more coverage of virtual memory, maybe. So there's going to be a gap, and I'm going to review virtual memory, and I'm aware that this might be annoying for some people who've taken 3030 or COA 2, where maybe you remember all this stuff. Also related to this, a scheduling note. So that we're gonna, our first assignment on virtual memory is paging protection, and that's scheduled to be released on Friday and due the following Friday. I'm not sure we're going to be far enough in lecture on Thursday. I'll make a decision on Thursday about that. If we're not far enough along, I'm going to just push the assignment to the following Wednesday and probably all the future assignments to the following Wednesday. So just a note, I'll make that decision when I figure out how far we get on Thursday. So questions about prereq issues in the scheduling note? Okay. So virtual memory is about address translation. That when we have two different processes, you know, we set up a mapping so the two different processes actually access different locations in memory. And this allows, say, program A to think, oh, my stack, you know, is at some address, and program B can think the same thing and actually they don't have the same stack because their stacks are in their data segments, which the OS has set up to point to at different locations in real memory. So we're going to talk concretely about how that mapping works. So as I said, many of you have seen virtual memory before, which we're going to review, and we're also going to look specifically at how it works in 32-bit x86, because that's what XV6 uses, and you're going to have to, for the future assignment, modify some of that virtual memory management code. So to actually set this mapping, typically what we're going to do is we're going to do paging. So we're going to divide up memory into fixed size pieces, which we'll call pages. And here I'm representing the program memory. So this is on the left side of this mapping, what a program sees. And I'm saying for this example, I'm going to have a 10-bit virtual address. I'm going to divide it up into four equally sized pieces. And I'm going to call each of these equally sized pieces a virtual page. So by virtual, virtual is the name I'm going to use for the addresses program sees, which I'm going to contrast with physical for the addresses that the machine sees after the mapping is done. And these pages are all the same size, and that's something we're going to keep consistent. We're always going to use pages of the same size. In this case, they're 2^8 bytes. It's not a coincidence that it's a power of 2. Because that's going to makes it easy to figure out what page something is in. Because I've chosen a power of 2, the first page starts at this nice round number in binary. The second page starts at this nice round number in binary. You know, and I can figure out what page it is by looking at the upper bits of the address as a result. And I'm going to take advantage of that a lot. It's going to make things a lot more efficient and also come up a lot when we're writing the operating system code that needs to deal with these pages. So I'm going to call this these upper bits of the address that say which page it is, the page number, in this case specifically the virtual page number, because it's the page number that the program sees. And I'm going to call the rest of the address the page offset. And we're going to set up a mapping where we take whole pages of virtual addresses and map them to whole pages of physical addresses, which we'll call physical pages. So I'm going to take my real memory. In this case, my real memory has slightly wider addresses. And I'm going to divide it up into pieces of the same size as I divided up the virtual memory. And I'm going to assign each of the pieces in the program's memory, that the virtual memory, to one piece of the physical memory. So this mapping of a virtual page number to a physical page number. And I haven't actually assigned all of the virtual pages, so I've said that one of these virtual pages doesn't have any map. And we can think of this as being a segfault page. So if your program tries to access things in this map area, it's not going to work. And otherwise, this table represents these arrows, and this table is closer to the format that the machine can use, and we'll call this a page table. Note that I've drawn this part of it, the page table, sort of with a box around it, because that's what we'll actually store. That we don't need to store these indexes because we know what they are. We just need to somehow give the processor this, the contents of this table, you know, and it can figure out, oh, this is the second row, so it's virtual page one. Okay. And so the operating system is going to give this table to the CPU, and the CPU is going to use that to actually run the program's code. So in the CPU, it's going to have access to this table in some form. And one thing we need to do is we need some way of representing this none entry. So our solution to that is going to be that we're going to add this extra bit which says whether an entry in this table is valid, and then we're going to have the physical page number for all the valid entries. And again, this stuff that's in the box, this is what we'd actually store, and these are just the indices that we use to set each of these entries. And when our program's running, well, the CPU is going to generate an address, and rather than accessing memory, well, directly with the address, it's going to use the page number from this address to look up the row of this table, and then it's going to get the physical page number from that, and it's going to take the page offset part of the address and just copy it. Why do we copy the page offset? Well, because if we have something which is, say, a quarter of the way into the virtual page here, we all want to get something that's the same part of the physical page it maps to. And that's going to do that. We also have to worry about what if it's not valid. In that case, we're going to have this check that we're going to trigger an exception if it's zero, and that's going to be something that where our OS gets to decide what to do. So one example of something we could do is we could say, crash the program by and print segmentation fault to the console. We'll talk about some other things we can do, and that's going to be the subject of the upcoming paging protection assignment. And we call this thing that we look up here a page table entry. And as a review, we call the that first part of the address the virtual page number, the corresponding part of the address that the actual, you know, real memory uses, we call a physical page number. And the page offset is the name for the part we copy. So a question, so why did I have this valid bit? Couldn't we just have chosen a special physical page number? That is a choice that could have been made. It's very uncommon as far as I've seen. And you notice that in this particular example, well, we kind of used all the possible physical page numbers. So we need some extra information to deal with that because all 000 to 111 are all valid, so we'd need to add an extra bit anyways. Okay, so I've shown you sort of this in a toy example. So we're going to be dealing with XV6 for 32-bit x86, and 32-bit x86, rather than having 2 to the 8-byte pages, has 4 kilobyte pages. That's 2 to the 12 bytes. And we've seen how addresses get split up, so let's do that for this example address. Split it up into a virtual page number and a page offset. And let's say we did that table lookup and we found this physical page number and it was valid, of course. So what would the physical address we get at the end be? give another 15 seconds or so. Okay, so of those who answered, it looks like a plurality have the right answer. So, sort of a way to go about this, thinking about this, is we have 4,096 byte pages. So that means virtual page number 0 is virtual addresses 0 to 4,095, or in hexadecimal 0 to OXFFF. Virtual page 1 is addresses 4,096 to 8191, which is, you know, 4,096 times 2 minus 1. Because it's another 4,096 byte chunk, which is OX1000 through 1FFF in hexadecimal. So it ends up being the case, just because, well, you know, 4,096 is OX100, that this part here is our virtual page number, and this part is our page offset. And it works out in hexadecimal because 12 is a multiple of 4, that we can just divide things up evenly in hexadecimal. We don't have to convert to binary or anything like that. So that gives these answers. So virtual page number is the first part. Rest is our page offset. And to use this physical page number, we combine it with the page offset to get the actual location. So, questions about how I figured this out? Okay. So far I've shown this kind of flat page table, but that doesn't actually, there's several problems with that. So one issue is just the sheer size, that where are we going to put this? So if we think of like, you know, a real translation, we'll have this huge, well, not huge, a 32-bit address, which has this 20-bit virtual page number. So it seems like we have 2 to the 20 entries here, and that's pretty big. And there's two solutions that we're going to use to deal with this. So we can't just like store this table in the processor. There's not enough room. And, you know, we want to still have it be fast. So there's two things that processors do. One is that it's going to be kept in memory, that the table will not actually be stored on the processor, like in a special register or something. Instead, there's going to be a pointer to a memory location the OS has set up for the processor, which has these entries. And the processor is going to use some caching to make that not hideously slow. The other thing is that we're going to use a tree-like structure. 2 to the 20 entries, that's pretty big. And usually, most of these entries are going to not be valid. And rather than storing most of those invalid entries, especially because there's going to be large regions of invalid entries, we're going to store only a subset. And to do that, we're going to take advantage of, well, how do programs laid out? Well, we have, like, say, the code and the globals and, like, the stack. And we typically have these large regions of, you know, unused memory. And the goal here is, you know, don't store many page table entries for this. So we're not going to like completely succeed, but our goal is going to be that we're going to have a tree-like structure where at the top of the tree we'll say, oh, this whole region is invalid, rather than, you know, needing to store a table entry for each thing in that whole unused memory region. So what this looks like on 32-bit x86 is that there's a two-level page table structure, that we're going to have a, you know, a special register that points to the base of this first table, And there's going to be an array of what we'll call first-level page table entries. And these are going to point to not the actual location in physical memory for that range of virtual page numbers, but the location in physical memory of a table for that range of virtual page numbers. So if we want to look up virtual page number, say, 0xc34, we'll first read the page table entry here, and we'll discover, okay, I know where the specific page table entry for this range, page table entries for this range are, and we'll find in somewhere in here is the actual location of the program's data. If we say looked up some address like 0x433, we'd look up this entry, and you know, we could have this first entry tell us there's nothing there, rather than needing to store this array of entries for the next, you know, for the specific element. We can store one entry that says all of these elements are invalid, there's no data. So have these arrays at each level, and it's actually going to be stored as an array, so there'll be array of entries, which are just hold the physical page number, some other data. We'll look at exactly what that looks like a bit later when we talk about how XV6 works. And some of these entries at the first level can just say, it's not valid for all of these pages, rather than needing to point to a specific entry for each of the pages in the range. So at our first level, our entries will contain whether it's valid. We'll also have some other metadata. So one example is we'll have, is it accessible in user or kernel mode? Is it writable? And there's, in practice, a whole bunch of other stuff the processor might support having in these entries. And the address of the next page table at our first level. And then at our second level, we're going to have an entry for each thing in the range. So in this case, I'm looking at the second level page table that was pointed to by this fourth entry here. And so it starts, so this is the first thing in this second level table. So the first thing in the table is for VPN C00. Why? Because it was pointed to by the first level entry for that range. And it's going to tell us this time where the actual program data is. So here, finally, this is where the program's physical page number. Okay, so questions about this two-level paging structure? Okay, so some naming notes on this. I'm going to generally use the term first level page table for what, you know, sort of the base of this structure, which are page table base register, the way the OS tells the processor where it is set to. You might also hear it called a top level page table, or in Intel's documentation, or the XV6 source code, the page directory. And this thing the first level page table entries point to, so that next level I'm going to call generally a second level page table, and Intel confusingly calls it a page table. So Intel uses the term page directory for the first level tables, page table for the second level tables. Sorry. But this is just sort of an inconsistency between Intel's terms and what most of the rest of the world uses for page table structures. So I'm going to say a process has a bunch of page tables. And there's a question, does this mean that XV6 Intel has exactly two levels? So 32-bit x86 has exactly two levels. 64-bit x86 has more. I guess I should be more specific. 32-bit x86, as used by XV6, has exactly two levels. the 64-bit x86 or x86 and 32-bit in another configuration might have more. So question is, why does 64-bit x86 have one? So 64-bit x86 has four levels by default, maybe more on some more recent machines sometimes. And the reason why you'd want more levels than this is that, well, you know, we want to keep down the size of this second level table, and if you have a much bigger address, well, you know, two levels isn't enough to do that. So in 32-bit x86, the way XV6 uses it, the way this structure is going to work is we're going to have 4-byte page table entries, which are going to be stored in memory, and a two-level table will use the first 10 bits of the, you know, of the virtual page number to figure out where in the first level to look up, and the second 10 bits to figure out where in the second level to look up. And the remaining 12 bits of the address are the page offset, which say where in the page we are. And XV6, well, it needs to manipulate these, so it has some macros to deal with it. So here's, in from the XV6 source code, they have a convenient diagram which shows sort of how a virtual address is split up into the offset in the page, and the index in that array of page table entries at the second level and the first level. And they have these macros which do the appropriate bit shifting to extract that, and also one which, given a directory index, a page table index, and an offset, reconstructs an address from that. So questions about... Okay, so since we've looked at page tables, let's finish up with this exercise here. So let's say we have this page table structure. So first level uses the first 10 bits, second level uses the second 10 bits. We have 4-byte page table entries. So note that this means that if our page table starts at address 0x1000, then this is the location of the first, you know, index 0 entry, and the second entry is therefore at the index 1 entry is at 1004, because these are 4-byte entries. So given that, here's a virtual address, here's a base pointer. So this is the start of the first level table. This is the value that the OS would provide to the processor, and we have the physical page number that's in the corresponding first level page table entry and the corresponding second level page table entry that the processor actually looks up when trying to access this address. Okay, so to start going through this, we have our VPN is 0x12345, and we need to split that up into two halves. So we have the first 10 bits, and that's going to be 0x48. And our next 10 bits is going to be, well, let's just start with 0x48. And that means that our first level PTEs at the beginning of the base address plus 0x48 times the PTE size. Why times the PTE size? Because that means that, you know, because it's the entry index 48, entry index 1 would not be at 1 byte after the beginning, it would be four bytes after, so we need to handle that. So we get, I believe, none of the above. Because 0x48 times 4 is 0x120, so our actual address is going to be 0x1120. And for the second level, well, we're going to figure out where the second level page table is using this. This is the location of the second level table. And that's where we're going to find this physical page number 15, but it's not actually there. And we need the second 10 bits of the address for that. So that is, I'm going to use my calculator here so I don't mess this up. The second 10 bits is 0x345. So the first 10 bits was 0x48. The second was 0x345. And we're going to again have to deal with doing the base address of the first level table. So that's the physical page number. So it starts at 0x14000 hex because we have to add a page offset to make a complete address. And this is at 1400 plus 0x345 times 4, which ends up being 0x14d14, I believe ends up being. Yeah, 0x14d14. So questions about how I got this number. So why 0x345? Because if I take this address here, I have 1, 0, then 3, then and I'm just taking the part, which is the VPN. This is our 4 and... So this part, this is our VPN, which is 20 bits. The first 10 bits of it, this is the first 10 bits. And the second 10 bits are here. So the second 10 bits, this is in hex, is 345. This in hex, this first 10 bits is 48. Okay, so this is, I'm over time, so I'm going to stop here, and we'll pick up on this next time.